Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
And welcome to Signs of Life Radio, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation, located on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Our number here, toll-free, in case you'd like to call in, is 1-877-230-3062. If you have instant messaging on AIM, you can plug in Signs of Life Radio and communicate with us during the show. We have an extraordinary guest. Now, I know we always say that at the beginning of the show, but this guest truly is remarkable. He's a neurosurgeon, medical doctor, obviously. Dr. Alan Hamilton, he wrote a book called The Scalpel and the Soul, Encounters with Surgery, the Supernatural, and the Healing Power of Hope. And needless to say, he's not your standard Harvard-trained neurosurgeon. He's had a life journey. A lot of personal experiences, a lot of experiences communicated to him by his patients, and he's going to talk about them all. We're going to bring him on very quickly. We just want to first talk about the conference coming up. I know we have, this week we had a new added...
A bonus. We've got a bonus because Suzanne Northrup was trying to clear out her schedule to join us. And so she's topping off, and she's going to be our keynote medium speaker at the luncheon in the afternoon. So I think right now we're at 10 mediums doing spirit communication in the afternoon while our guests have an unbelievable gourmet luncheon. And that just follows a jam-packed morning of learning the evidence of survival of consciousness as seen by science, and live demonstrations of electronic voice phenomena, courtesy of Tom and Lisa Butler from the American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena. They were the consultants on the Hollywood movie White Noise. I guess they pretty much know what they're talking about.
Yeah, and in talking to Tom and Lisa Butler, they're going to try to do a little impromptu experiment to see if we could pick up some spirit voices.
Right. And we're in a prime place because we are at the Woodlands Mansion in Woodbury, New York, on Saturday, November 8th. We're starting at 9 o'clock in the morning. There'll be hot coffee at 8:30 to warm everybody up. A nice cool November on Long Island. And it's going to be an unbelievable experience, particularly when they try to gather that EVP, because that mansion has a history all of its own that we're not going to share right now. We're going to leave that up to the butlers to see if they can capture some of that.
Yeah, well, you'll have a little bit of everything. We'll get some, hard science from Dr. Swanson, who wrote the book The Synchronized Universe. He's an MIT physicist, and just as our upcoming guest has learned a lot from his work, Dr. Swanson has come to believe certain things from his work as a physicist. So that day, we'll have a little bit of everything. I hope you can join us. The information you can get on our website.
Including the discounted hotel rooms. There are a lot of people who are traveling from out of town, so there are special arrangements made. There are special rates, group rates at the Hilton Huntington, and they are also providing a shuttle bus to bring the people back and forth to the mansion. There's also loads of activities on Long Island if you want to extend it, and the Hilton will honor the same rate if you want to make it into a little mini vacation.
Okay, and that takes care of business. And with that, we are going to go to a short break because I'm anxious to bring on our guests.
I think everybody's anxious.
Okay, so stay with us, and we will be back in 2 minutes.
great pleasure to announce the formation of the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Baischel, Director of Research at Winbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Winbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science, while also broadening their focus to include questions about what our bodies, minds, and spirits are capable of, and how that information can best serve all living things. In addition to this cutting-edge research reviewed by an experienced and diverse scientific advisory board, Winbridge also certifies and trains research mediums and publishes the free, online, peer-reviewed Journal of Mind-Body States. Please go to www.winbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute and how you can become a member of Winbridge, and for a list of certified mediums and opportunities to support specific research. That's www.winbridge.org.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Has your marketing pitch been missing the strike zone? Maybe you need a new player to help your marketing efforts. At L&R Productions.com, you'll find a team that can give your broadcast advertising the winning edge. L&R Productions has produced award-winning jingles, radio, and television commercials for many businesses just like yours. Radio and television advertising work, but you need the right game plan. Make sure you're getting the most out of your ad every time it airs. www.lndrproductions.com. We'll throw strikes for your business every time.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
And welcome back to Signs of Life Radio, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation. The number here, 1-877-230-3062. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce our guest, Dr. Alan Hamilton. Dr. Hamilton attended Harvard Medical School. He went on to become the chief of neurosurgery and chairman of the Department of Surgery at the University of Arizona Health Services Center. He's currently a professor of neurosurgery and a clinical professor in the departments of radiation oncology and psychology. He's also the executive director of a medical think tank that seeks to improve surgical technique and at the same time reduce operating room errors. Dr. Hamilton is also, as if that's not enough, he's a script consultant for neurosurgery for the TV show Grey's Anatomy. His book is The Scalpel and the Soul, Encounters with Surgery, the Supernatural, and the Healing Power of Hope. Welcome, Dr. Hamilton.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Fran.
And, what struck me, a lot of things struck me, I've been reading the book, and it's a wonderful book. I was intrigued when you went on to describe what you go through in the actual process of doing surgery. You know, you get into a zone. You talk about being, completely absorbed in the work, and you even mention the phrase, time stands still. Mm-hmm. But, when I read that, I said, boy, this is a form of meditation. Would you say that?
I think it definitely is what we would, qualify for most of us, is a flow state. It's one of these, your own voice tends to, that inner voice, that monkey brain sort of tends to get very, very quiet. And for me, it really is, you look up at the clock and you go, where did 2 hours go? Or you look up and see that the staffing for the operating room has rotated and you had no notice of it. So it is a very kind of otherworldly state of mind.
Hmm. Now, I don't want to give away too much about the book, but it's a compilation of stories and experiences and encounters you've had with patients. But you begin the book describing an incident where you literally came to a fork in the road, or I should say a fork in the river.
Right.
And while you were in Africa. I was very intrigued by that. Can you give our listeners a little taste of that?
Sure. That was really, for me, a watershed event. I had just gotten out of Harvard, and I'm sure I had the swelled head to go along with it, and went to Africa. And one of my first assignments in Gabon, which was the country where I went, was to go out and vaccinate some of these outer-lying villages. And there are no roads, so what they do is they wait for the wet season when the river rises. And they gave us a boat, a kind of a dugout, really, with a little engine on the back of it. And we got it all packed up. And then I had it pulled up on the shoreline, ready to take off. And unfortunately, during the night, the river rose and washed this boat away. So we spent most of the day looking for it downriver and then dragging it back and re-outfitting it. And then, the gist of all this is we were delayed by one whole day, and finally went down the river. And because the river was so swollen, and had risen so much, there were the landmarks that our guide was using to tell us where to go. A lot of them were lost, and we were told we were going to come to this fork in the river, and one side was going to lead us to the villages where we were supposed to go to vaccinate the children, and if the other side would go to the Atlantic Ocean. And what we needed to do was go to the bigger of the two forks. And as fate would have it, the river rose and the forks, as we were coming upon them at a fairly high speed in the torrent, were exactly the same size. And, we were going left, right, right, left. And finally, at the last minute, I said, just crash land into the fork in the river. And we did, and we pulled the boat up, and we're just lying there panting in the mud. And I look up and I see this incredibly handsome African gentleman with a beautiful mane of gray hair looking down on us like we're the two most ugly drowned rats the river's ever washed up. And I spoke to him in French, and I said, we're lost. He looked down at us and said, yes, I know. And I said, I went into my whole spiel. We're here to go to this particular village. And he said, yes, I'm here to take you. And I was sort of taken aback. And he said, I came because I had a dream. And in my dream, it told me that you would be lost. And the dream told me that I was to wait here to lead you to the village. And then he said, but the strange thing is my dream told me to be here yesterday. And I'm going, well, there's no radios, there's no telephones, there's no smoke signals. How could he have possibly known we were delayed by a whole day? And then, I'm sitting and thinking to myself, well, here I am, a Harvard-trained surgeon, lying in the middle of the African jungle, and my ability to fulfill my medical mission is now dependent on the dream of a complete stranger, and his faith in that dream to wait for another whole day there for us to get there. So, I began to think, well, maybe the world doesn't work exactly the way I learned back in Boston.
Mm. I think that's why you said that you lost a great deal of your faith in science in Africa.
Well, I think science, in a way, is our own mythology in the West. And I think one of the things that, Africa is so infused with folklore and the supernatural and taboos, and you begin to sort of sense that the world can have a completely different explanation, but that's just as functional and is just as good an explanation for people as what we sort of allude to with science.
Mm. I know To get back to that story a second, which you didn't mention, is that that African tribesman who was standing there, didn't his name, the translation of his name, mean something like the having to do with dreams, like this?
It meant something the equivalent of comes to you as a messenger, and you know, it was a very, very strange. You know, it couldn't, to me, it just could not have felt like a coincidence.
Right. I agree. I mean, it's statistically improbable. Here you are, you pretty well thought you were done in, and that was the end. You didn't mention that already one of your predecessors had perished, you know, doing the same type of work that you were doing there. So you had to be a little bit shaken, and you were, in effect, you know, saved and by something that just kind of blew your world apart, I would imagine.
Yeah, and I also learned, you know, that, you know, we practiced medicine there at the hospital. You know, I'd be on one side handing out, you know, medicine and digitalis and antibiotics, and on the other side, through these open windows, there'd be a witch doctor, you know, who was literally brought there by the family to sort of make sure that we were basically covering both sides of the medical issues. And you sort of, you know, learned, it was almost like having a consultant, if you will. You know, I'd go on the inside of the hospital and they would work the outside of the hospital, and you sort of felt as if, you know, both sides, both body and soul, were sort of trafficking back and forth through this open window. I think the whole issue of, you know, deciding versus choosing really became clear to me. You know, this issue of, you know, we tend to justify decisions to believe or not to believe based on, you know, well, this is science and this isn't science. And, you know, I think there's a difference when you say, I choose to believe. There is no defense required. There is no explanation required. It's just, this is my choice, that the world, I choose to believe the world works like this.
I know that you describe in the book that you had a ritual that you would go through when you were preparing for surgery.
Mm-hmm.
You would, I believe you'd actually be in the shower and, you know, or in the home, certainly, and you would visualize the entire process of the surgery, you know, in your mind.
Right.
So you describe it as taking place like in real time.
Right. It was, I do it every morning before surgery in the shower. And I'd basically sit in the shower and I would, in my mind, start to see the whole operation. And it would, to me, it would be as if it was, I was watching a film almost. I would go into the operating room, I could see as if the camera was panning back and forth over the instruments, and then I would see the whole operation unfold. And I guess it was my mental way of preparing and thinking about each step, but at the same time, you would sort of get a gestalt, if you will, almost, about how the surgery was going to go and where the difficult technical parts were going to be and where there, you know, a mishap could be sitting around the corner, kind of thing. And it just became, you know, my ritual that I do every morning before surgery, kind of thing.
Mm. Now, during this process, at the same time, if you visualize something that didn't feel right or look right, you know, using these physical terms that we have for our senses, you wouldn't hesitate to postpone a surgery, correct?
No, absolutely. I'm a big believer that, you know, every surgeon should use, we should all bring whatever gifts, you know, God gives us, we should bring all of them to the table. And certainly in medicine, you want to bring your cognition, you want to bring your fund of knowledge, you want to bring your eye-hand coordination, but you also want to bring your intuition. You know, when the little hairs on the back of your neck stand up, you should listen to them. And I've had plenty of times where you've had a premonition. I tell a story in the book that I'm almost embarrassed about, because I was driving to work to get ready for morning surgery, and I just happened, as happens, I live in the desert in Tucson, Arizona, and there was a rabbit that had been run over, and there were two, three vultures just sitting by the side of the road over this carcass. And it's one of these images that sort of just grabs you, you know, and I drove on into work, and I was getting ready to see a patient who was going to the operating room, and as I usually do, I went in and said good morning and said, you know, everything going okay, we'll see you in a couple of minutes. And I walked out the door, and they're wheeling the patient out, and the patient's wife leans over the railing, the bed rail, and gives him a kiss and says, don't you worry, my little bunny, everything will be all right. And all of a sudden, this image of that morning's drive with that dead rabbit just for some reason just was resonating with me. And I went out to the front desk, and there just happened to be a nurse that I'd known for years. And I said, well, don't ask me why, but just do me a favor and take this guy and postpone him till later in the day on the schedule. I just got a bad feeling, and just don't even question it. Just go ahead and do it. And I told the patient something had come up. And about 2 hours later, he had a massive heart attack. And he would have had that heart attack right in the middle of brain surgery when it would have been very, very difficult, not just to diagnose, but to do anything reasonable to treat it. And as it turned out, there he was, waiting in the pre-op holding area, monitored. He went up to the coronary care unit, did very well. We operated on him about 2-3 months later. But, you know, if I hadn't listened to that kind of vague gut feeling and premonition, you know, I'm convinced at least that this guy would have had this heart attack during my operation. It would have proved fatal.
Mm. And I'm sure that if you were brave enough to relate that story to some of your colleagues, you got a few raised eyebrows.
Oh, I have to tell you, raised eyebrows is not half the story after this book came out. I had a number of colleagues who came up to me and said, you know, you're a chairman of surgery. I can't believe after 25 years in the field, this is what you decided to write. Now, that said, I also have a lot of colleagues who come up and then say, you know, thank God you were willing to talk about it. Let me share with you a story about what happened to me, what happened to my parents. And, you know, I had one colleague that I've known for about 20 years who was in the elevator with me and was just shaking his head and said, I can't believe, you know, this is what you wrote. And then as he steps off the elevator, he looks back at me and says, on the other hand, whenever something bad has gone wrong with has happened to my children, I always know it and I sense it before the phone rings. And I looked at him and I went, "What? You know, what are you trying to say to me? You have a premonition?" But you know, that's surgery. It's the most arch conservative part of medicine, and this is an area that shakes everybody up. We all see things we can't explain. We all see patients who, against all odds, turn around, and you know, it goes against everything that we've learned in medical school, everything we've been taught about rational scientific explanation.
And well, of course, you know, you were performing a very delicate, you know, as a brain surgeon, I mean, you can't get more precise and skillful in what you were doing, and you performed, you know, remarkable, you know, surgeries on patients with very serious, you know, brain tumors and so forth, and yet you say that despite all of, as you look back over your career, despite all of these, you know, remarkable surgeries, that it's the spiritual connections that seem the most memorable and the most worthy of sharing.
Yeah, I really do feel that way, Bob. I think in a lot of ways that's the whole point of the book, is that you know, we see these feats of technical skill and whatever, but it was hearing, watching my patients go through spiritual challenges as they faced, you know, severe illness or major surgery, and watching them undergo a spiritual transformation and basically reaching out to all the powers greater than themselves, whether it be their family, their religious faith, a sense of oneness with a cosmic consciousness. It didn't matter. This was when people felt the greatest drive to reach out. And to some extent, I just learned from them, both directly and indirectly. They taught me, and some of their spiritual challenges quite candidly reflected back on me and made me question, you know, my own values and what I was doing and some of my own motivation. And so it was really the spiritual awakenings and lessons that resonated the most for me. And I think I was also taken aback. I was surprised that this was happening not once, not twice, but time and time again, and that nobody had been willing to even broach the topic with me and say, you know, you're going to see things you can't explain. You're going to see powers at work that are going to seem remarkable and beyond the realm of comprehension, and that's part and parcel of the human experience. But nobody was even willing to whisper about it.
Dr. Hamilton, I have something I'd like you to consider. We always look at medicine as hard science. The average person will look at medicine as hard science. And then there's the opposite end of the spectrum, which is pure healing, where people will do hands-on healing or prayer or that. So you've got two ends, and you're right smack in the middle. You're putting the two together. What are your thoughts on that, that our listeners want to know how you incorporate both and end up right smack in the middle? You know, people either go one way or the other. You know, either I'm going to a regular doctor or I'm going to a healer.
Isn't that kind of surprising? Because, you know, when you go into the hospital, you sort of expect that your body's going to receive intensive care. When you go to church, you feel like your soul's going to get intensive care. But really, the two are the same thing, and they both need care at the same time. I'm always surprised when I talk to physicians, every single one of them, every single one, without exception, if I say, have you seen a patient that you thought, you knew they were going to die quickly, but then they turned to you and they said, you know, I've got to last till Christmas so I can say goodbye to my family. Or we had a woman who said, I've got to hang on till my son comes back from his tour in Iraq. Mm. And you say, okay, so here's this process that we think is a mechanism, it's a machine, it's a biologic entity. And yet somehow, against everything we know and believe, this patient survives and keeps themselves alive until they are able to achieve emotional closure. And you say, how does that happen? And you say, well, people impose their spirit, they impose their will, they marshal their emotions. We have no problem accepting that. We have no problem accepting that people can die from stress, from anxiety, from their fears. We know that people, for example, in voodoo, we know in voodoo cultures that people who believe in voodoo, perfectly healthy young people, can die in a matter of days if they believe a curse has been placed upon them. Science has no problem believing that our fears can kill us, but we have a problem understanding that our beliefs can cure us. So I think there's every reason to want to be in the middle, because that's a reflection of the human condition. We are not just bodies. We know that our emotions affect how our body responds. We are part spirit and part flesh, and that has to be addressed at the same time.
And we are talking with Dr. Alan Hamilton, author of The Scalpel and the Soul. I want to mention that for those of you in the Seattle area, that would like to see Dr. Hamilton in person, he's going to be at two venues, October 1st at 7 p.m. at the East-West Bookstore, which is on Roosevelt Way in Seattle. You can find out more about that if you go on eastwestbookshop.com. And he will also be on October 3rd at the Rampa School of Enlightenment giving a lecture, and you can get more information on rampa.com. You know, I wanted to mention, I thought it was kind of humorous, is that Fran and I watch very little TV. the one show that we will happen to watch is Grey's Anatomy. As a matter of fact, as soon as
we're done
with it tonight.
Tonight's the two-hour premiere of the season, right.
It's perfect timing, you know, because we just go right into that. And, you know, as we watch the shows, the reason we like it is, you know, we like to, you know, as we're watching it, we notice that some of the themes seem to be, have a spiritual overtone to them. For instance, the one episode discussed near-death experience.
Right.
Others question, you know, what happens after we die. And we're always saying, boy, we should really try to find out who the writers of the show are. Really
they're some of the best in Hollywood, but I'm just their consultant.
I know, but, you know, then when I found out you were the consultant, I said, aha, I think we may have found the source of some.
How did that come about? Well, you know, it just came about because one of my, you know, as we talked about at the very beginning, I'm very interested in, in what medicine can do to eliminate errors and medical adverse events. I mean, it's the fifth leading cause of death in the United States now. Five times more people are going to die from medical adverse events than are going to die on the highways of America. This is a huge problem. So I was very interested in computer simulation and how we could visualize surgery to eliminate errors. You know, we kind of talked about the mental sequence I go through in the shower, but and that just led to a couple of episodes where they were interested in computer graphics and 3D visualization, and one thing led to another. And then because one of the main characters, Patrick Dempsey's character, Dr. Derek Shepherd, is a neurosurgeon, there's almost not a script that goes by that doesn't have some neurosurgical story or sequence to it. And the writers are very, very good at looking at these dramatic storylines, and then they go to different specialists and say, look, I need something that will bring out such and such an issue in this particular episode. And and mostly what we do is sort of try to make things look as real and as accurate as possible within the dramatic confines of the stories that the writers have put together. There's never as much sex as there is on television.
You sure?
We couldn't get any surgery done if we were that busy.
You know, now I think it's a fair statement that there are very few Harvard-trained medical doctors that have sought the services of a shaman for their own personal ailments. Do you think that's a fair statement?
I think there's a cure for it, though. I did have a very insightful personal experience, and, you know, I don't necessarily have any explanation for it other than I was there, my family was there, I experienced direct firsthand what it felt like to have a shaman minister to me. In brief, I took care of a young boy that I was very close to who was in the process of dying from a malignant brain tumor. I actually took a couple of days of vacation, and because I wanted to be sure I was there, and he passed away. And the next morning, I happened to have off because it was, I'd taken the day off. And I was just reaching for a cup of coffee when all of a sudden I just felt like I had been struck by lightning. I just fell to the floor. I felt like I was paralyzed. I couldn't move, and I was just lying there. And eventually there was a knock at the door, and in walks an old friend of mine who I knew from the medical school here in Tucson, who happened to be a Navajo. And I just looked at him and I said, holy smokes, thank goodness you're here. And he leaned over me and said, I'm going to go get help. And I thought, they'd bring a truck around or call an ambulance. And about an hour and a half goes by, and he walks in with this gentleman who's obviously a Native American who only speaks Navajo, with long, gray, white, silver hair. And he's talking to my friend. My friend's translating for me. And he leans over me and says, you have to get up and sit over by the fireplace that was in my living room. And I said, no, I can't move. And he said, no, you'll be able to get up. And then, all of a sudden I sort of got up, and I ached, and I sat down. He said, take off your shirt, and started a small fire with herbs and sage in the fireplace. And the next thing I know, he says, bring your whole family out here and have them sit with you. They have to be here. And I had young children. I mean, I can tell you their eyes were as wide as, coffee saucers. They were just looking wide-eyed at what was going on, wondering what was happening. And he started to chant, and he started to work from behind me with a feather fan. And all of a sudden, there's this incredible amount of perspiration just pouring off of me. I remember the waistband of the pants just literally soaking in front of me. I could see them gathering moisture. I hadn't mentioned a thing about what had happened the day before about this boy. And the next thing I know, through my friend, he's translating, he says, I feel him passing into me. I feel as if his hands have somehow moved inside of me, and to this day, I can't describe it as anything other than it was a sensation of pure love. I don't know how else to describe it. And then he, through my friend, says, this pain, this is from holding on. You're holding on to the spirit of a young person, a boy who wants to pass over, and you're clinging to this person. And this is them trying to work their way free, and you have to give them permission to go, to slip over and to pass over to the other side. And he gave me instructions about what to say and what to do, and I did what he told me, and all of a sudden I felt the pain just suddenly leave my body. And, by this time it was actually fairly late at night, and I was, feeling better. I could move around, and, I didn't know how to end all of this. I really wasn't very familiar with the practice, so I asked my friend, I said, well, what do we do? And he said, it's traditional now to give a meal to the medicine man to thank him. And I said, well, geez, my goodness, it's 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night. What am I going to do? And I said, it's very late. And he said, well, all I know is he came when you needed him. And I said, well, good point. I said, well, I really don't know how to make anything much besides spaghetti and meatballs. Is that okay? And he said, sure. So we had a spaghetti and meatball dinner with my kids and my Navajo friend and his medicine man. And, there we were. And, I still to this day, I know what I felt. I know that I thought initially it was something terrible, like a ruptured disc or something. But, all I know is this man ministering to me somehow arrived at the emotional conflict that I was feeling, attributed my somatic, my body's feelings to this. And there was no question I was very tightly in the grip of what had happened the day before, and very grateful to him, for his ministering to me and tending to me and healing me, and the sense of great love and warmth that was coming from him, of great caring for what was going on inside of me.
Hmm. Very interesting. And today, even to this day, you've refused to accept money, only meatballs and spaghetti from patients.
That's right. That's my usual surgical fee as Chef Boyardee.
One part of the book was you tell a story about a patient, Thomas, who despite incredible suffering showed great fortitude and wisdom. And in a very poignant statement, you make a statement in the book where you say suffering is not the point of living; it's the background, the context against which we discover love's power over death and over illness. You go on to say that suffering is what lends love its supremacy over death. Can you talk a little bit about that?
When I think when all is said and done, when we look at the arc of life, the one thing that I have seen and experienced with through my patients and through my own family, but the one thing that seems to transcend everything else is love. The sense that, we are mortal souls locked in a kind of a physical isolation. How do we get beyond that? How do we get to that? What John, Dunn said was that no man is an island, that we're all connected and one big continent. Well, what is the power that allows us to transcend that physical isolation? And the answer is love, that when we can suffer with another person and feel their pain as our own, when we can literally say, I would rather be in their place than have them suffer, that when they die, a part of me dies, that is quintessential magic and power of human beings. At the beginning of the story, I told a historic thing about Amundsen, who was was a famous polar explorer, and he happened to one time his explorations I guess went on a little too far into the fall, and he got trapped in the winter ice above the Arctic Circle and had to winter with this Inuit tribe. And as sometimes happens when you have a stranger in your midst, you don't put them right in the center of the village. You sort of want them on the edge a little bit. So it just so happened that Amundsen got parked with the shaman, with the medicine man. And again, the medicine man, being as sort of Fran suggested, this intermediate between the flesh and the spirit, is again often physically on the verge, on the edge of the tribe, of the community. So this is where Amundsen found himself, and he was there all winter, and he sees all these sleights of hand and, you know, these tricks with smoke and the blubber coming out of the person's hands. And, you know, finally, he can't take it anymore, and he decides he's going to confront the shaman and says, doesn't it bother you, you know, doesn't it get to you that all of your magic is nothing but, you know, smoke and mirrors? And the medicine man turned to him and said, my power, my magic, is that I've been out on the ice alone, and I have heard the voice of the universe, and it is the voice of a mother calling after her children, and that's my power. You know, and I don't think you can put it any better than that. That is the power of love.
Yeah, and you know, I've often thought, and we've discussed this on the show, you know, that love itself may be, you know, more than, you know, a simple emotion. It could be an actual conduit of communication. I mean, when we look at some of the various phenomena, near-death experiences and mediumship and so forth, a lot of the communication seems to come in the strongest when there's this bond of love. I mean, there's even some evidence in some telepathy experiments where, you know, a connection between two people enhances the ability, you know, to convey thought. So, you know, who knows? We may discover that love is something that could be quantifiably measured, you know?
Well, there are some very interesting experiments coming out where they've shown that people who are, you know, literally we people who are married often refer to each other as soulmates. And in this one experiment, they actually used a acupuncture needle to have a person feel, you know, a little stimulus, and their cortex would light up on an imaging study. And then they put the needle into the person they loved, and exactly the same area where their loved one was experiencing the pain on that brain scan lit up in their own brain. Literally, they were feeling the pain that their loved one felt in a very real, certifiable, verifiable neuroanatomic study. And I think that is in a way is going to ultimately bring about the verification of what you just said, that when we say we love somebody, we're in a special state of connection where literally we may find that our brain is linked directly to the brain of the person we love.
Mm. I know that part of the book is actually the end of the book, A Scalpel and the Soul, you list 20 rules to live by, some words of wisdom and advice. One of them struck me where you say, I don't know which rule it was, I don't know that it matters, but live your life with death in it.
Oh, number four.
Okay.
you know, these are things that that I've learned from my patients, but, and it sounds morbid, but what it means is death is the great yardstick in our lives. Death, you know, I've had, you know, patients, a lot of patients where you've been with them while they're getting ready to prepare themselves for dying and so on. I've never had one of them turn to me and say, you know, doc, I wish I'd spent more time at work. What happens is they reevaluate their lives, and very often for cancer patients, this is the threshold of a spiritual transformation where they look at what they love, they look at their legacy, they look at their values, and suddenly what they care about is crystallized for them. So death is a wonderful tool, if you will, to use to remind ourselves that we need to assess the real value of what we dedicate ourselves to.
Hmm. A lot of us, you know, when we talk about people, they say, well, you know, he's very lucky or he's very unlucky. And, you know, is there such a thing as luck, and how does it play into our daily physical lives?
I don't know how you can explain. I think life begins with an incredible amount of luck. If you think of the billions and billions of combinations that one egg and one sperm and all of that DNA could make, and yet here we are, that one single unique individual brought into existence. You know, how do you explain that, I talk about this in the book, that a drunk comes across the median and crashes, you know, head on and kills an entire family. And if that family, if the driver of that car had been postponed for 10 more seconds looking for their keys that day, you know, how do you explain that somebody missed the flight that was crashed into the World Trade Center? You know, you look at all these things and you've got to say to yourself, you've got to be humble enough to say, I am not in control of this. The fact that I'm not born starving in Africa, that I'm born into a world where literally I started off as a janitor and ended up going to Harvard Medical School, I can't take credit for that. That was luck. That was whatever was meant to happen, was written, but I'm not in control of that. And I think admitting to luck, good luck or bad luck, is a way not only of being humble, but also admitting we don't understand everything that happens to us. I can't explain why a two-year-old child gets a brain tumor and dies or develops leukemia. I can't sit there and say, this is how this was supposed to unroll. I have to turn around and say, you know, this is just some bad luck, and this is going to have some rippling effects, and I don't necessarily have the wisdom or capacity to see into it beyond what it is. So I've got to attribute it to fate and to luck.
Yeah, and that, of course, you know, by the nature of the work that we do, and we're always in contact with a lot of people that are suffering or grieving, either, you know, emotionally or physically, and it's probably the overriding question. You know, some people would choose to believe that their circumstances brought about by design, and some would say that it's brought about by the, you know, luck of the draw, or that, you know, we live in a world, the physical world, that seems to be random. And it's a very I'm sure you heard that question a million times from your patients. You know, why me, doc? You know, is it something I did, or
right. I think it's easier if you can say, you know, it's fate, or this is what. But you know what? What always troubles me is when somebody says, maybe I'm being punished, and I don't see the universe as punitive. I don't think an earthquake is visited to devastate 250,000 people because they deserve it. I think the universe is loving and caring, and that there are natural forces unleashed, and to some extent they're haphazard, and there's randomness, there's chaos built into the beauty of the universe. But I certainly hope that, you know, when I see a patient who says, you know, this is my punishment for doing this or this, and I sort of say, you know, the universe is far more unconditionally loving than that.
Mm. One thing we didn't touch on, which it was very interesting to me, is that over your career, you developed, I guess, for lack of a better term, I'd say developed, you know, the ability to tell when a patient was close to death. I think that you actually visualized the, mm-hmm. you know, a coloration, you know, like under the skin. Yeah. Do you think that this was a product of your medical training, or some sort of intuitive gift that you had?
No, I actually noticed it when I was first working for a veterinary surgeon, and we would put, you know, unfortunately you have to put some dogs to sleep, and so I would hold them while they were being given the euthanizing injection, and I would often see this very funny light come in around them as they took their last breath, and I didn't even think about it after that. I only noticed it when I was a medical student, and it's not like I walk around and go, you know, on the elevator, whoops, there's somebody's going to die. It's not like that. It's just sometimes I'll see that funny kind of light coming just as that person's getting ready to pass over to the other side. And it's, you know, and if they pull back from the edge, you know, the color that light fades away. It's just kind of a yellow. I just describe it sort of almost like a waxy color, like the reflected light from a candlelight. And, you know, I don't know what it means. I do know that as I've gone around the country and talked with a lot of people, particularly people who work in hospice, many of them have come up to me and said, yeah, we see that. And we see this funny kind of light coming into people just as they're getting ready to pass over to the next life. And, you know, again, it's not something I walk around and I don't go on rounds every morning and go, you know, this is the person who's going to die. But when I see it, I really do sit up and take notice of it.
You know, you talk, and it's in the title of your book, about the power of hope. Do you think when you look around the current state of medicine, are you hopeful that more and more health professionals will be integrating some of the things that you've learned of an intuitive and spiritual nature and integrating that into their practice? Is that something that you hope would bring about change in the way we treat patients?
I think it has to. I think medicine is very spiritually ill at the present. I think the patients are stressed, and I think the physicians are unfulfilled. I think things are unraveling. I remind people, you know, we now go into hospitals and see, you know, the fathers are in the delivery room and they're gowned up and they're cutting the umbilical cord, and I go, you know, none of that was thought up by obstetricians. That was thought up by the women themselves, who said, no, this is not right. This is not how I want my baby to come into this world. I want my spouse there. I want my significant other by my side. And I think the same thing's going to happen. I hope it will happen with spirituality, is that, you know, as consumers, as patients, we are not happy being treated just as a physical illness in a body. We want to be treated as a whole person. We want to be looked at both as a spiritual and a physical entity, and I think that change is happening. And I think I see signs in the younger generation of physicians and medical students that there is some awakening going on.
I know that we're nearing the end of our talk, but rule number 13, to heal quickly, avoid negative influences.
We have to take responsibility for the energy that we allow around us. We all have individuals that are friends or family that somehow put us on edge, that disturb us. We watch the news. It's war. It's the economy. It's anxiety. And then you say to yourself, you're in the midst of recovering from major surgery. You're vulnerable. Is this when that energy needs to be around you? Is this when you want to allow negative influences into your life and into your body? And the answer is no. You have to protect yourself, and you have to say, nope, I'm not going to allow this energy around me while I'm vulnerable.
And so I assume that you would champion the belief that the mind can be very effective in healing certain disease. I mean, if we can rid ourselves of thinking negative thoughts and then bring a tangible result.
Guided imagery and all the rest of that, visualizing and activating every aspect of our central nervous system and the great gifts that our brain has is very important to recovery.
We have been talking with Dr. Alan Hamilton. You can find out more information by going to website www.alanhamilton.com. And Alan is A-L-L-A-N, Hamilton.com. His book, The Scalpel and the Soul, Encounters with Surgery, the Supernatural, and the Healing Power of Hope, is available at pretty much all sources. But if you go to our website, at ReverendFamilyFoundation.org, there is a description of the book with a link where you can just click on it and buy it at Amazon. We will, of course, the show will be archived. You can click on that anytime. We also plan on adding that to our list of recommended reading, so that will be there in posterity.
And it's in our newsletter.
The newsletter is at the printers, and we will be sending it out probably in about a week. And there is a book review. I highly recommend this book, and it'll be an enlightening and spiritual experience just in reading it. Again, if you want to see Dr. Hamilton in person, October 1st, East-West Bookstore, Roosevelt Way in Seattle, and also in Seattle on October 3rd, RAMHTA School of Enlightenment, which, and you can go to their website, RAMHTA.com.
R-A-M-H-A.
Dr. Hamilton, thank you so much for joining us. I hope that you'll join us again in the future. It was wonderful speaking with you.
Bob and Fran, thank you so much, and God
thank
bless.
You.
It's been a wonderful discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, and have a good evening, and we're going to go watch Grey's Anatomy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Get our ratings up. That's great.
Okay.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.
And with that, I would like to tell everybody that your loved ones are just a heartbeat away. And
science is going to prove it.
Good night, everybody.